Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Welcome to this evening's Fireside Chat. Very delighted to have Vice President Reynes with us, Representative Herr, and Dean Delaney. I'm going to briefly ask you to each introduce yourselves. I know that you know each other generally, but perhaps a little bit about who you are, where you are today in work, and maybe something you've done this week to take care of yourself. Let's start with VP Reynes.
So, hi everyone, my name is Maria Reynes, and I am currently serving as Vice President and Chief Nursing Officer for University of Minnesota Medical Center and Masonic Children's Hospital as part of the mHealth Fairview system. I've been in this role for about 2 months, but I've been within the organization going on almost 17 years, and I've been a nurse for about 23 years in a variety of roles. And this week I got to spend time with my mom and dad down in Florida. My dad had to have a small surgical procedure, and I got to go down there. I had not been able to see them since the beginning of the pandemic, so a little bit over a year. So that really was filling to my heart to be able to go down and spend time with them.
Thank you so much. Representative Herr.
Can you all hear me? Can anybody hear me?
Yes, you're perfect. She might have lost sound.
Can you hear me now? Okay, my internet is really unstable. You would think at the state office building, I would have good internet, but I don't. I didn't even hear the question because I kept going in and out. So I think I'm just gonna guess what it is that I need to say here. But so I'm state representative. Representative Khalid Vang Herr, and I have been a state representative. This is my second term. And so this is just really my third year. I was elected this year as the House Majority Whip, which is a really big honor. I think that a lot of times people think they have to be here a really long time or be seasoned to take on some of these roles. And so I was really surprised when I did get elected into this role. I think I heard the last piece was like, what do we do to take care of ourselves or relax? Is that the other part? Take care of myself. So I would say I don't do a good job of taking care of myself, but spending time with people I love is a really good way to just kind of fuel my heart to keep going. So that's I try to do that a lot.
Thank you so much. And I have to say in our last fireside, there was also a guest who said, I don't do a good job of taking care of myself. So perhaps we'll have the interns help generate some ideas for how to do that. And Dean Connie Delaney, it would be great to have you introduce yourself as well.
Thank you, Carolyn, and I'm delighted to join my colleagues this evening and to meet each one of you. I'm Dean of the School of Nursing and completing my 16th year in that role here at the University of Minnesota. Prior to that, I was at the University of Iowa, University of Utah, things like that, focused on the academic role and research, primarily in the use of technologies in healthcare and taking care of myself. I think family and friends are a daily dose of family and friends is essential. I'm going to share three quick comments. And for me, that means really celebrating the daily doses of interactions with the staff and faculty and the students of the School of Nursing or the university, and Maria, we're partnering all the time. On a more everyday Connie level, I am very meticulous about sleep, meditation, and breathing fresh air.
Thank you.
Every
Breathing every day that's great.
It's important. We've traveled a lot together, Carolyn. You know that.
I do know, yes. Thank you. Great way to get us started here. I'll remind the interns that you're more than welcome to put a question or comment in the chat. And I do have some of your questions. One, to get us started really with a conversation. My hope is that we can talk and just exchange some ideas and insights here. So during the pandemic, what is something that you as a leader have learned about yourself as you think about what you've gone through really for over a year now? We've passed this milestone of the first case in Minnesota. We know that it was here in the United States even a few months before that. And now here we are a year later. Maria, I'd love you to chat a little bit about taking leadership with Bethesda. I think that would be fabulous. And then really with Connie and I'm wanting to say your first name right, Cooley?
Kali,
thank you. Mm-hmm. So Kali, certainly share some experiences because I know all of you have been leaders through this pandemic.
Thanks, Carolyn. So I'll start about the pandemic and taking leadership. So I had the opportunity the last year. I've been in our healthcare system, which was Health East. So I started there about 17 years ago. Started my background in nursing as a critical care nurse at the Mayo system and had an opportunity to get my master's degree at the University of Minnesota and really focus that in my clinical. So I became an adult GERL clinical nurse specialist and entered the Health East care system, really focusing on clinical work. And I think as life makes turns and as chances and choices are given to you and opportunities, decided that I really appreciated nursing operations and I could build on that clinical knowledge and had an opportunity to step in and take a chance to be a nursing director of a nursing unit and really felt that my skills and that experience that I had was well aligned with doing that. I've had an opportunity to step in and do a lot of different roles, director of nursing at Woodwinds Hospital. I moved over to St. John's and ended the last 7 years or so before moving to the university campus at St. Joseph's Hospital and had a lot of different experiences and opportunities, things that when I went to nursing school, I never thought I would be doing. So I had an opportunity to plan and develop and actually help build nursing units for mental health patients. And that was just such an experience to be able to look at it from the nursing viewpoint, what was going to keep our staff safe and be able to get that feedback from the staff, but then also look at it from the clinical viewpoint. What are those things that are important to patients that are coming in seeking mental health care as we were developing both an adult unit and a gerontology unit? So that opportunity was given to me. I was able to draw upon it. And as I've learned in the skills the last 23 years that I have been working as a nurse, last year's old skill really became important. I was asked as part of the role that I had at St. Joe's to also help turn Bethesda Hospital around and open the state's first COVID specialty hospital. Bethesda Hospital, as a background, was a long-term acute care hospital, which means that those patients that are there really have stopped needing that acute care, but they need more intense rehab than just being able to go home or go to a nursing home. And so the patient population there is a very acute one. But we knew that both within our system, but in the state, because of the pandemic, there was a need to utilize additional hospital beds as all the hospitals were becoming overwhelmed with the amount of patients. And as we were experiencing those patients in our hospital, we also learned that by cohorting or joining those patients within one structure in one hospital, we were able to put together protocols and policies, build efficiencies, and most importantly, keep our staff and our patients safe because our nurses and our doctors and respiratory therapists and everyone in the healthcare team didn't have to go from caring from one patient that didn't have COVID to caring caring for another patient that did. So within a matter of 2 weeks, we essentially emptied Bethesda Hospital from those patient population that they normally took and turned it around into a COVID hospital, bringing together within our system all kinds of healthcare providers. So we had, of course, nurses that came from the 13 hospitals that mHealth Fairview has. We had doctors, nurse practitioners, respiratory therapists. And I had the blessing to really bring those teams together and partner together to say, what do we need to create? What have we learned in the last month? Because we were kind of early in the pandemic. Bethesda opened as a COVID hospital at the end of March. And really draw in that teamwork. And so one of the skills that I really learned both for myself, but for our team, was perseverance. The ability to look at something and think that it almost feel like it's undoable. How do you turn a hospital around and open it back up in 2 weeks? It almost feels like it's a task that no one can accomplish. And the ability to draw on people's skills and abilities and come together as a team. So this was not something that I did alone. It was something that we were able to create together and bringing the learnings and the skills that people across our system had. And we were able to open and ran that hospital for 34 weeks at a full capacity. As I look at the metrics that we were following, we had one of the lowest incidences of staff getting sick from COVID because of the protocols that we were able to put in place in there. And a lot of it was learning on the fly. So I guess another skill that I learned for myself and the teams was being okay with some ambiguity. We don't know what the pandemic was going to bring to us. We didn't always know if a plan A or a plan B was going to get the outcome that we needed, but we had tremendous amount of leaders that were willing to try things because it just wasn't written anywhere. So we just came together and we were able to do that. And we were able to share the learnings with our other hospitals in the system that still were getting COVID patients. And that ability to share not only within our system, but through the state, as other hospitals were reaching out with questions and what are you doing and how are you doing that, really brought all the healthcare teams in the state together to really do that. We had to search to St. Joseph's Hospital because we also ran out of beds at Bethesda. At some point during July, we just had more COVID patients in our hospital at Bethesda than what we could. And so it was a very easy transition to bring all those learnings back to St. Joseph's and quickly be able to convert. I think our nursing teams and our provider teams really worked well, even in this time of ambiguity and scariness. People were scared. They were scared to come to work. They were scared of how are we going to bring this back to our families? And I think having open communication and really being honest and vulnerable with each other really helped us understand where people were and how staff was doing with this. So those were kind of the things that I think in the last year, didn't think that it could be possible to open a hospital in 2 weeks and provide the needed care that we did.
Thank you. You gave us a lot to think about: perseverance, being okay with ambiguity, open communication, honesty, vulnerability, just so many great reflections on that experience and what it took to do it. Connie or Cooley?
I can add a few comments. The first is, Maria, your summary and your accomplishments, your whole team was phenomenal. Both were phenomenal. And thank you for what you shared. Many of those related to the School of Nursing, turning on a dime. So within 2 weeks, a staff and faculty literally turned 4 degree programs into online. And with that came the never wavering from our mission and why we're here, the beacon. We're here to address what is a persistent nursing shortage, whether it is entry-level nursing inpatient care across all settings or advanced nurse practitioners or educators and deans. But the couple comments I'd like to share, one is, and Carolyn, you've experienced this, so you know, always comment as well. I found as a leader that it was the staying steady on the beacon, and if you will, absorbing as much as possible and sorting out what's relevant for the fullness of the team to know as compared, in other words, absorbing as much stress or deflecting it or whatever word you want to use, and putting the people first in terms, what do they need to know, and how do we work in community? And as a leader, that brings out that titration of how directive. So we're literally in a crisis. I'm an ICU nurse. I know that. But also balancing it with listening, compassion, empathy, and those all of that. And then keeping in every way that I and we could, our organization and people away, or not prioritizing being fear-based. So being hope, what we do, recognizing the pain and the stresses, but not moving into a fear-based way of being in the world. And right to this day, as you said, Maria, being always prepared to turn on a dime, yeah. Always parallel plans. We're still that way, as you know, in the university on decisions that have to be made.
Carolyn, I'll just add really quick, because my experience is probably very different than Maria and Connie's experience. But the one thing that I learned about leading during a pandemic is that there's nothing like adversity or challenging times that really test who you are as a leader. And if you are a leader who does not operate from an authentic place and you do not know where your true north is and your center is, it's really difficult to lead, because there are 1,000 competing priorities during that time, you know, in those spaces. That can really, if you don't have a good set of values or your core of what leads, what guides you, centering you in this work, it makes it really difficult for others to follow you. And I would just say, for, you know, one example is that equity matters to me. But a lot of times when people think about equity, they think about, like, you know, equity just from a social, like from, you know, from like a social service standpoint or a social justice standpoint of like in certain specific areas. And I always tell people that equity and inequities lie in all places. And when we were rolling out the vaccine, you know, we worked really closely with the governor's office for that. And, you know, like there were just things that we were just trying to get vaccine rolled out that we didn't think about an equitable distribution of vaccines. But if you're not somebody who is thinking about that, as it was being rolled out, I started asking questions to the Department of Human Rights, of the governor's office, asking them, I'm hearing that people who have barriers to language and to access are saying they don't have any idea of how this vaccine is getting rolled out and how they get access to it. And the fact that as we were asking those questions, nobody else had asked those questions, that were people getting things out in a language that somebody would have access to? What about people who have huge issues with a digital divide and having access to the internet so that they can get the information that we're distributing it? And so it was just really interesting to kind of see. And so asking the Department of Human Rights, we need to track when people are saying that they feel like they've been discriminated in this process in order to get access to the vaccine. That would to ask the governor's office to say, we need to have a weekly briefing on how there's equitable distribution of the vaccines, you know, that there were things in which that we had to ask for, but yet we were still trying to fund our doctors and nurses and our frontline workers. We were still trying to make sure teachers were getting into classrooms, that children were being able to learn, were learning. And yet we had to find out where were the most marginalized people getting impacted in all these different areas, you know, around housing, around if you're not housed, you're not getting information to be able to get you to a place where you can get information to get yourself vaccinated, right? And so there was just so many different ways in which we were looking at inequities within all these different systems and how they were intersecting. But if you did not operate from a place of value of what something meant to you, it would be really difficult to start asking all the questions you need to ask to ensure that you can execute on a strategy that is fair and equitable. And so I would say that, you know, that was what I learned within this process of those who had that, it was much easier for us to work together to figure out a plan forward.
And Carolyn, I would add to what you just said, Representative Herr, that we learned from a more of a patient care and family and community care perspective, similar issues. So as the pandemic continued and as we opened up both the specialty hospital, but all the hospitals in our system were being taxed and challenged, we of course had to enact a lot of the guidelines around specifically call out visitor restrictions. And that is where we discovered the amount of support that families and community give to our patients, specifically patients that English is a second language or patients that have a diverse background. And as a person that is from a diverse background, I appreciated that not having the families there and the differences that language can make in how you interact with a patient, how do you interact with a family. So one of the other skills that the team really had to get quick about was creativity. So how were we going to be able to fill that gap for our patients, both the ones that were on a ventilator that we knew could not communicate with their families, and we had to be that conduit of communication to keep those families and communities informed as to what that patient was doing, what were the needs, but even the ones in our medical units. And the system really rallied together and coming up and identifying what other places were doing. And so I never thought that an iPad would become such an instrument to be able to fill that gap and to be able to bring families together. We were able to quickly enact things within our electronic medical record that allowed us to have privacy and ensure that we were following HIPAA and other rules to ensure that, you know, patient information wasn't going. But we were able to bring families into the patient's room, into the patient care, which we as nurses, of course, know they are so important for the healing of our patients as they are making decisions about their own healthcare and how we transition them to that next level. And those iPads became a lifeline for our patients and our families, both to connect with the healthcare teams, to be able to be in the room with that patient on those daily things that you just take for granted when you're able to bring families together. And to this day, we still have that. We were able to bring translators. It became really difficult to identify how do you keep some of our staff safe, knowing that bringing them into the hospital with the N95s and the fit testing and the PPE shortages that the state and the hospitals were having to deal with, we were able to leverage technology to really say, we have a need in our community, we have translators that we have in a variety of languages, we need to bring those translators into the space where care is being done for our patients and be able to utilize technology and bring teams together that before, I don't think that anyone had thought of certain things.
Thank you for that. I'm going to look at the interns. Is there a follow-up question or reflection at this point that anyone would like to offer?
I'm curious how you kind of ensured that there was like good communication and teamwork amongst everyone on your team, because usually with a crisis like this, that can be very hard to keep people together.
I would say that the teams became really close together, and we utilized processes that were already in place, and really we refined those processes. So certain things that we put in place at Bethesda to ensure that we were minimizing the risk to our patients. So one of the things that we took a chance, and when I implemented it, you kind of think, is this going to come back and backfire on me? But we required that all nurses that were working at the hospital and all providers had to work 12-hour shifts. And the reason why we implemented that was that the number of handoffs that we know have the highest risk for a provider, whether that's a nurse, whether that's a respiratory therapist, whatever that role is, to transfer that information about the patient and what's happened increases the more people you have to get that information through. And so that was part of our tactic was we need everyone that is working at the hospital. They have to work 12-hour shifts. You take a chance. There's not a lot of people that like to do that because it is taxing on the body to work that many hours, many days in a row, but it really helped us to ensure that the handoffs that we were doing within the teams were minimized. The other thing that we did was we were able to ensure that some of our bedside handoffs and bedside reporting with the teams, we refined the processes that we already had in place and had tried at hospitals. We did a lot of teaming with the families. So the nurses came up with a process because what they were doing, they were getting a lot of different calls from families wondering. And so they came up with ideas that they were willing to try. And again, because I felt like Bethesda was almost like a little lab that we were running there and people were willing to try things for the sake of the patient, for the sake of the safety of themselves and the families and the patients, we implemented calling families twice a day. And so there never was a question by our families as to when we were going to communicate. We designated roles that would always serve as those communicators to our staff. And I think to Connie's point of really having that true north or what is that, that you are always there, all of our staff had two things in mind, keeping our patients safe and keeping each other safe. And that really helped us ensure that we were always like, I'm watching your back and you're watching my back. And that really kept us through the entirety of the hospital being open. Those were the two most important things as we looked at processes and trying things is, let's look at it from the patient safety, let's look at it from staff safety always.
Thank you.
Carolyn, if I might respond with two quick points to Sarah's wonderful question. Sarah, the one of the human characteristic and particularly, you know, culturally and how we are in Minnesota and particularly how we are in healthcare, crisis, we're there. It's like every type of boundary just dissolves and we're there, we make it happen. And you've heard such wonderful examples from Maria. And then things emerge. So my two points are, one of the, in this dissolving is, was for us to realize how closely we're linked to the school system. When kids can't go to school or to preschool and parents need them at home and they need to be teachers. I have one faculty that go, I'm a magnificent physiology professor. I don't know how to teach third grade math. And it's this, all this mixture of dynamics. So it was unbelievable, dissolving a boundary and then seeing the emergence of all these solutions. But the second point I wanna make is all along this journey, which now we're, you know, literally marking a year, we've had times when, if you will, the crisis has let up. And that might be a time when a leader kind of relaxes too, not me. That's when I redouble my attention, because as we go through those waves that we have been through, and we're about to go through really big ones now, on how do you hold the community and the team in a supportive way so that what were great solutions persist, because they're easily forgotten. So we started documenting them every day of the week. And now we're going back to those to review them. What do we want to take forward? Don't wait until it's over because people can't remember. There's so too much change. And second, that we're entering increasingly into a phase of where we could lose that very sense of and living of true community and team because of the, if you will, the crisis kind of lightening up. So those are the discussions we're having in the school. We know individually we all have choices in how we want to live our life going forward. My question to the school is, how do we live as a community going forward? Or how do we live in community with Maria, with your teams? Yeah. It's a wonderful.
Go ahead, Connie.
No, no, I'm done. I want to thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Herr?
Well, I'll just add really quick that I'm the type of leader who never believes I have all the answers. And so, Sarah asked about communication, that I think that it's especially during difficult times, like we've experienced this past year as a leader, is to make yourself as open as possible to other people and their suggestions. I oftentimes feel like how we've been operating is so hectic and so disorderly. And I'm reminded by our majority leader that no one has ever led in a pandemic like this before. No one has ever tried to roll out, vaccines the way we've had before. And no one has ever tried to rally a whole state around such dividing values, even in just asking people to wear their masks, right? And so oftentimes, yes, as leaders, you have to be really decisive and you have to be able to give clear orders. And then you have to be really clear in your communication and what the goals and the objectives are. But that it is equally important to let people know that you are as vulnerable as they are and that you are looking for solutions and suggestions and that no one has a corner on all of the solutions. And so, to make sure that people understand that you're open to feedback. Some of the best things that we've implemented didn't come from another leader. It came from somebody who was literally, doing the work every day that said, we need this, right? Or if you did it this way, it would be much more helpful. And that, so I think it's really important if good communication goes both ways, not just you being able to communicate well what your goals and objectives and your plan is, but for you to accept what is coming your way and be able to implement it and use it, and then redistributing that information back to other people. And that process is really important.
Thank you. I put in the chat a bit of a longer question, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but I want to touch on one thing I've heard that might seem a little bit like a paradox. So we've heard you speak, all of you, to being vulnerable. We've also heard you speak to absorb the stressors, present that, I would interpret that a little bit as present the strong face sometimes too. So you want to show your vulnerability. At the same time, you're making tough decisions and you're absorbing a lot of information to make those difficult decisions. I know that both can coexist. Do any of you have an immediate, just kind of quick response to that?
I don't know if there's a quick response to that. I have to be really honest. I cried once in caucus, so I'm not a crier. I never cry. I think like the one time I cried all year was like in front of other people, but it wasn't crying because I was exhausted or I was really, didn't know what to do. It was literally like when you carry, I think what Connie was saying, like when you absorb everything, you are literally carrying everybody's, not just like the responsibility of the job, but you are carrying everybody else's like burdens and their emotions. And like when you need somebody to come into work, but they have to like teach their kids at home. And when you need somebody to execute on something, but like they can't get, they need public transportation and none of the public transportation was open, right? Like there's just, you're literally carrying everybody else's, their things with you as well. And I don't know if during this time there is a good balance, because I know that when I carry other people's hearts and souls and like spirits with me, I'm not somebody who's good at like taking care of myself. And so it wears me down, even though it takes a lot to wear me down. So I cried and I told people it's because it's okay that we won't always have the answers and I won't always have that strong face. And some days we just need to cry together because that is the only thing we can do at that point. And so, I don't know, I think that, I don't know, I guess that's really all I have to contribute to that, because I think that as leaders and especially as women leaders, right, people expect us to show up in a different way, because if we show emotions, it looks like we aren't strong enough, right? And how do you show up and do this work and show strength, but also show people that it is okay that like during this time, we sometimes just can't absorb everything. And that's really important to create a space to allow people to do that too.
Representative Herr, as you were saying that, I was reminded, yes. And our COVID huddle, which met every day for a while, and then, once a week and those transitions, the call for transparency and vulnerability, I think, is just so paramount. And one of the ways that exhibited itself, and we lived it in our COVID huddle, is, you know, sometimes when people are hurting the most, they can't talk. Mm-hmm. And I know we're all on Zoom, but, you know, day after day, when we see each other, we actually know what something's going on. Like I might say to Carolyn, today you're different.
Yeah.
And being open to being full human beings, let the professional stuff, it's there, but at our core, being a full human being in relationship to each person and being observant and being vulnerable enough to say, something doesn't feel right. What's going on with you? And anyway, that occurred all the time with us. Yeah,
that's really, really helpful to have you sharing some of those insights. I was thinking about this question in the chat box about some of the changes that you've made either personally or professionally within the organizations that you plan to keep after the pandemic urgency is past us and we're in our new normal. And I was kind of chuckling to myself that you're representing state government, you're representing a major healthcare system, you're representing a university, or the largest university in our state. These are not easy beasts to tame or change. And yet we've shown dramatic flexibility. But will we eventually get back to, would the pendulum get us back into the middle of where we always were? Where will there be some things that have changed and will change for the good? What do any of you think?
So Carolyn, I think that as I have come into my new role, but even with the teams that I had both at St. Joe's and at Bethesda, one of the things that we have been talking very openly and honestly is, how do we lead differently in the world that we are in? Both because we continue to live in a COVID pandemic, and although we're making great strides with vaccinations and other things, the long-lasting impacts, emotional, physical, psychological, and for our healthcare system, financial, are going to carry us into many years ahead. And we have extremely tough conversations about what those impacts are, and being honest about not knowing what the next year or three or five is going to bring. And so I'm really challenging both myself, but the leaders of what are those things that I can't say when the pandemic ends, I will do this, because the pandemic may never end in the sense of this may be the new world where we're living, where we have something else that we need to worry about. And so we're really engaging our teams at the hospital level to really have that change a little bit, because otherwise you're always just waiting for something to end and like the old world is going to come back. And I think for some of our leaders and some of our staff, it's letting go of what that old world looked like, and how do we take care of patients in this new world? How do we connect with community and family in this new world, both at a hospital level, but at the clinic level? And then identifying those things that have really worked in this pandemic that we want to continue. So one of the examples is telehealth. At Bethesda, we did not have the ability to bring in every consultant for every need that the patients had. Yet we gave exceptional care for our patients because we were able to leverage the ability of our collective system to be able to bring specialists to the bedside without physically getting in a car, driving the 10 miles and so on. So I think if we look at that, we have both in our system, but as hospitals in the state of Minnesota and healthcare systems, how do we bring those consultants that not every healthcare system has, those specialists that not every healthcare system has, to be able to provide the care that our patients continue to need, not only because of COVID, but because of other diseases. And so that technology needs to continue, and we need to continue making strides. And for those that say, well, I can't, you know, I can't do that because I need to be next to the family, next to the patient, really challenging ourselves to say, this is our new way of creating care that is going to open access to patients that live in areas that are underserved, that areas that are remote, that you don't need to live in the metro for us to be able to do that. And we have hospitals in our healthcare system that are way out of the metro. They are in very remote areas up in Range, up in Hibbing, where we've been able to leverage some of the things that we've learned today to now say, this is our new way of creating access and care for those patient populations.
Good example, thank you. Representative.
I just wanted to add up, Marisa, because actually I was thinking about telehealth in my mind, and I was thinking about when you said the new normal and the pendulum swinging back, and my feeling is that I hope the pendulum never swings back to the middle. It was during this time that we became more innovative than I think I've ever seen us be around everything that we do. And we've been fighting actually for in the last biennium for more support for telehealth. We could not get it. We could not get LastPass. And yet after this pandemic, people realized, oh my gosh, we need to build out this infrastructure. We need to support our hospitals and clinics in doing this. But we started realizing that that was the same issue in court cases, that we had to do like court cases. And really understanding that we thought we were fixing, we were just trying to address an issue around people having access during this time where we couldn't be physically together. But we realized that people were not missing their court dates. And especially those who are the most disproportionately impacted are Black, Brown, and Indigenous people and low-income individuals who had transportation barriers, who had language barriers, who had the inability to actually physically, because they might work two jobs, to show up at a court case. Yet they were able to now with these new systems. That when we were saying somebody in rural Minnesota had to drive 4 hours to get to see a doctor or a nurse, and that now that they, you know, like they don't have to do that, that they don't have to waste the time to do that. And that this environment forced us to see the infrastructure that we had created and to be able to be innovative in what we were bringing to people and how we were bringing it to them. So I hope that the innovation doesn't stop because we feel like everything is normal again. You know, and I think that even just from the perspective of like, no one ever thought that you could distribute vaccines in an inequitable way, right? Like when we started learning that some hospitals and clinic would have all these extra dosages of the vaccine, but they also had to use it in a certain time because they didn't want it to go to waste. So they were calling everybody they know to show up and be like, come and get the vaccine, right? But what we were realizing was that the only people that were getting access were those who already had, were educated, had access to people in the healthcare profession. And we thought, well, now there's all these people skipping this line and there's so many vulnerable people who need the vaccine, right? And it really forced us to say, as a state, what are the things that we have to work with our healthcare institutions to say, when you have extras, here is a network of people who are embedded in the, our in our communities, who we can get the information out to quickly so that they can come in and sign up and that we don't skip them and that they do have access to this as well. Like we would never have thought of that had we not been placed in this situation. And so innovative solution around communication, around access, around technology, like I hope that that doesn't change because we need to continue to do that.
Yes. To my colleagues, I'd like to add a couple comments. First, anchoring Representative Herr with yours, I hope we never go back. Too much has been discovered, and we're co-creating a whole new world. My two comments, one is very individual and the other quite global. The individual one is, I learned what it's like not to travel every week in the country or with Carolyn in countries around the world constantly. And what was possible. And Carolyn, I want to lift up the deepest gratitude for you, to you for your creativity on how we not only maintain, but expand and initiate new global relationships when we can't come and be in person, eat together, be in each other's space. It's been wonderful. But individually, I don't want to go back to the lifestyle I had before this. I've learned to rebalance and have a degree, a greater degree of rest and self-care and still function. And then my more global one is, I hope America maintains and grows the commitment to truly create a public health system we've all been picking up pieces here and there, and we've all learned. So we have an opportunity, I think, like others have said, this is just one thing. We know there are more coming, but we have a phenomenal opportunity to think like and live like a community. We're so individualistic, we know, but we have an opportunity as a full population to grow and consider others mm-hmm. and really create a renewed public health system.
Thank you, Connie, and thanks for those reflections and comments. As I'm thinking about the adversity and challenge and the crisis of pandemic and the telehealth innovation, I'm also thinking about the killing of Mr. George Floyd and others and what happened there to propel us into anti-racism and very aggressive, I wouldn't say innovation in the space, but it's in front of us, like you cannot ignore. And you know, those who have advocated for years are probably just thinking, come on, we've been advocating for years to face supremacy roots, to deal with racism. Those who were advocating for telehealth were saying, we've been advocating for this for years. And then within weeks, we pivoted. So, you know, I'm finding myself wondering is what's the next thing that we don't want to have to wait for a crisis to change about ourselves, our society, the way we work, the way we relate to each other. And I'm not saying any of us has the answer to that, but this is where visionary futuristic leadership, what's the problem we don't want to become a crisis that we should be innovating toward now? And I wonder if anyone has any thoughts about that, knowing we still have a pandemic to deal with, a triple, quadruple pandemic, really, when we think about the economic impacts, the mental health impacts, the anti-racism that we have to pursue, and of course, the actual infectious disease itself.
Carolyn, I'd like to offer a thought on that.
We have great.
All the things you're talking about. One of the things that could keep me up at night, but rather I meditate on it, is a deeper crisis that's going on in individuals as well as groups, communities, and our society. And that is, I need to share with you that my roots are in Indigenous way of being. And the call to recenter inside ourselves and know what our core passion, purpose, essence, you know, there are many, many words for these things, but re-anchor deeply in being a human being and what that means in relating to other human beings. And to me, for all sorts of reasons that we know about, technologies have good assets, but they're also pulling us away and out from being at our core, who we are. And to the degree that we can work with the little tykes on through all of our different generations to reinforce and support one another, but mainly turning and knowing your true essence. And that relates to everything that we know, whether it's global warming, planetary health. We have an earth that's falling apart right before our eyes. And I think that is and the social injustice, it comes back to deeply looking first inside.
Yep. Thank you, Connie. I'm gonna be aware of the time. We have 9 minutes. Representative Herr, I'd love to hear a few things in this space.
Yeah, so that's such a good question, Carolyn. And I think that I don't know if I could even answer the question the way you asked it, but I would just like to say that, you know, like as a lawmaker, or even maybe like if you work within a specific industry, right, a specific sector, we've always looked to solve problems within. you know, okay, let's solve the problem in the healthcare system, you know, and access and quality. Just like in the legislature, we say, let's solve the education gap, you know, the disparities within education. Let's solve, you know, the issue, the crisis with affordable housing. And what I've been saying to people was like, we are complex people. How is it that we show up to do our work and we try to solve problems in a very singular way? And that I think that for the first time, we pushed each other really hard to say, one, how does structural and systemic racism show up in all of our work in all of our sectors? But then how do we show up to do our work at the intersection of all these different systems? That I can't fight for somebody to have access to healthcare if they aren't getting paid livable wages so that they can pay for the healthcare, so that they can have access in this type of environment, right? We've been fighting for like universal healthcare forever. And we shouldn't have to wait for a pandemic to realize some people don't have the healthcare to help them so that when they are sick, they can get the help that they need, right? That they don't have to wait on emergency care and for all of you to run out of beds. And then for us to say, where do we send these people now, right? Like we shouldn't have to wait for a pandemic to see this, that the disparities that existed only became exacerbated with the pandemic, and they became very clear to us. So how do we solve issues at the intersection of, if I don't have housing, we know that those who are housed actually are healthier and then will rely less in the healthcare system. So we need to make sure that there is affordable housing, which we are in a crisis right now around that. We know that those who are Black, Brown, and Indigenous and are poor live in neighborhoods in which they disproportionately have to live the environmental impacts of pollutants. And those people then end up in the healthcare system more than you know, people who are educated, who live in areas that they know how to advocate for themselves. We know that children who show up at school, who then don't have a certain level of education, will end up in the healthcare system more because they are not able to advocate and take care of themselves or get jobs that will allow them to be able to have healthcare. So then for us to say, we can't just look at healthcare as healthcare. We have to look at the intersection of all of these different systems, the environment, housing, education, you know, healthcare, every one of transportation, right? All of these ways in which the systems intersect and how do we solve problems? And you all are at the center of that, because I always tell people, we're either going to pay now or we're going to pay later. We can pay into a system that gives everybody access, or we just wait until everybody gets too sick because they're too poor and they live in poor neighborhoods, that we've polluted the earth too much and now everybody's too sick and now they have to engage in the healthcare system, right? Like they're going to pay later if we don't pay now to actually lead in a way that shows that we understand pain comes at some point. And so I hope that we don't have to wait for another pandemic to see that payment should come now, so that we don't have to wait for people to suffer and pay later.
Thank you so much. That was fabulous. And I'm glad that you pointed out the intersectionality and really the interconnectedness of all of the different examples I was giving. Okay, we've got 6 minutes. I have a fun question, I think. So there's a question here about just old practice people who aren't on board with change. These are the up and coming interns that are really about team and team-based care and certainly reflexive leadership and leading with wholeness. There's got to be times when you all have experienced pretty dramatic pushback and how pushback with your ideas. We're curious how you handle that pushback. And I might add to, as you're giving some closing comments, what pushes your buttons and how do you deal with that? Like, are there certain somethings that challenge you, irritate you, get you going? And how do you deal with that?
So Carolyn, I can start. I think that, I feel like fear and ambiguity can get in the way when someone is pushing back on a change, on a decision. And one of the tactics that I have used and certainly became a very important one in this last year was really getting to the why. Why are we doing this? And if we have an opportunity to really explain the why behind it and engage that person in the conversation and understand what is underlying between I'm not going to do that or this isn't right, and really getting to that space where we can have a conversation of what is behind that wall that they're building about that change. And I think that that goes, in my experience with patient care, we know that we have patients that can do that. We know that as teams, we can do that. We know that families can do that. And so it's spending some time, I think, at the beginning to really understand, is it coming from a place of fear? Is it coming from a place of lack of information that is going to help them get to that space? And I think the other thing that I have learned is being okay, both not knowing all the answers and engaging the team, but also being okay that at times you're not going to make everyone around you happy. I make very difficult decisions at times, and those decisions, of course, have consequences. And I have to be okay that at times I know that this is not going to be a popular decision, and having to do that because we know that there is a benefit to those things, and then helping support those members or those team and leaders that may be having that. I think one of the things that pushes my buttons, if you've ever done the color wheel, I am a red, so I lead with red and yellow. And so during a pandemic, those skills really came because I am a get it done and direct communicator. Indecision or waiting for perfection pushes my buttons, because one thing that I've learned, and not only in this last year, but in the years that I've been a leader, is if we wait for everything to be perfect, we will be waiting for a long time. And just saying, I'm going to take a chance, it may not be the right thing, and we'll have to go to the next plan, has to be part of that skill that you have to be able to live with and be able to lead with. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Herr?
Sure, I will just add that I think that change is inevitable, and you all are the change that we've been waiting for. When you see how people who've been here before you lead, you're gonna be amazed at how this world operated before you all got here. And so I want you to know the way you are doing it is the way that works, right? And the way you are, the discipline that you are working towards, and how you're looking at leadership. And I would just say that for me, the one thing that I think really pushes me is that my buttons is that when people say to me, well, it used to be so good, or like, you know, but we used to always do it like this. And like, people are much more comfortable in what they know, even if it's not working. And that for us to remember that, like, our job is to show people that change is good, and that change is actually, you know, to show people that even if you don't want change and you don't know, you don't believe change is good, change is inevitable, and you are either going to come along with it, or the change is going to leave you behind. And how do you give people the tools to understand that, and then give them the tool to be successful in this new environment? Like, as a leader, that is the most critical thing you could absolutely do, is to understand the different people and whose risk tolerance for change, right? And then to give them the right tool to match them in order to move them with you. And that is what a really good, effective leader is going to be able to do. And so I always tell people to remember, the way things used to be might have worked really well for you, but I'm a woman of color. It didn't work well for me 40 years ago, right? Like, I'm an Asian woman. Like, I wasn't allowed leadership access, you know, 20 years ago. And so, like, no, it was good for you. It wasn't good for everyone else. And I'm going to create an environment that is good for everybody, no matter how they show up, no matter how they look, and no matter what skills and resources they bring to the table, I'm going to make it so that it includes everybody in this process, so it's good for everyone.
Fabulous. Thank you.
My quick comment would be, as individuals and as leaders, I want to reinforce, you are the future. A strategy that I've used most of my life is, when I'm afraid of something, I go right into it. Skydiving, we'll do it and see what it's about. Things like that. So I want to go after what I dread or fear. I want to clean the fear out of me. And how that exhibited itself in the COVID situation is that in our COVID huddle group, this was fairly early on, we started a discussion with pause, look at each other, and imagine who might not be here tomorrow. To bring the seriousness of COVID home right to our team. Carolyn, you might have been in that meeting. Several people cried. It was to ask that question we all avoid, the pain of one or more of us not being functional or not being here. And so it kind of circles around to what we've been talking a lot about tonight, and that is moving away from fear, whether it takes knowledge, experience, or exposing your vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Dean Delaney, Representative Herr, VP Raines. We're really, really thankful for the time and the candidness tonight.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.